You know what you're listening to?
Is that a trick question?
It's the I Still Love This Game podcast with your host, Matthew Damien.
He's an idiot. Don't listen to he's an idiot.
Hello and welcome to episode 57 of the I Still Love This Game podcast. We only have one game today, which was the Rockets and Jazz, and believe me, there is a lot to talk about that. And we've also got a couple of questions that I wanted to answer, and there's something that I want that's been on my mind a little bit about LeBron in the playoffs so far, so we'll get to that. But of course, we're going to begin with the Rockets and Jazz. And allow me to begin by saying how wrong I was about Utah. I thought after such a draining series up against Oklahoma, combined with the fact that Rubio was injured, combined with the fact how badly they played in game one, and how well the Rockets looked and how indestructible they looked in game one, I thought this series was a complete write-off, at the most five games. And I was completely wrong, so I put my hand up, and I'm happy to be wrong, because it looks like we may have a six or seven game series instead of a four or five game series. So let's have a look at how this happened. And there are similarities between this series and the last series against Oklahoma. The first game against the Thunder, we saw Paul George light them up from downtown. And we saw really soft perimeter defense in that game one from Utah. In game two and throughout the rest of the series, we saw a much more aggressive defensive effort on the perimeter by Utah, and that stifled the Thunder. And we saw periods where Houston was able to break free of that. But in the first quarter and down the stretch of the fourth quarter, Houston looked lost, especially on the offensive end. Harden was throwing up air balls and bricks, and Chris Paul, they were giving up mid-range jumpers to Chris Paul at stretches, but they could live with that. They were happy with that result. So we have seen some similarities between the two series, at least from the early stages of these two series. The only difference is, and I don't want to harp on this, is Houston is a much more comfortable offensive team than what Oklahoma is. Oklahoma has talent, obviously. Any team with Russell Westbrook and Paul George in your backcourt, you've got offensive talent. But they're nowhere near the offensive juggernaut that is Houston. And while Houston did struggle for stretches of this game, we saw Oklahoma struggle for, you know, really three, or not three games, but two and a half straight games. It wasn't until that second half of game five did they finally get it back into gear. But even then, of course, we saw what happened in game six with Paul George going 2 of 16 or 2 of 15, whatever that was. So I think that's a big difference. But in terms of what's happened with Utah, there is some points that we can compare what we've seen so far. Another difference that we've seen is Donovan Mitchell was shifted playing essentially a point guard. And if I can go off topic for a little bit, this is the reason why I think he should be Rookie of the Year. He adapted his game to what Utah needed, and that was a scoring play when he was alongside Rubio. And now with Rubio injured, he's changed his game back to being really a creator and a facilitator with the ability to score. Now, Simmons is great. I'm not saying he's not going to be... Look, if I had to pick one player that's going to be the dominant player in 5 years or the face of the league, I mean, it's close, but I would go with Simmons. But right now, if you put Ben Simmons in Donovan Mitchell's role throughout the season in the first round of the playoffs, I don't think he can be that scorer. He's not an explosive scorer the way that Mitchell is. But Donovan Mitchell has shown the ability to, maybe not as good as Ben Simmons in terms of facilitating and controlling an offense or running an offense, but today he looked fantastic in that role. And that versatility and ability to adapt your game to what your team needs is really what separates All-Stars from Hall of Famers. Or I should say Hall of Famers from the All-Stars. Because that's what gets teams over the hump. Because in the playoffs, it's all about how can you counter. Because you go up against teams that are good enough to take away what you do best. Typically, unless if we're talking about the 2017 NBA playoffs, and then it's just let's clear the way for the Cavs and Warriors to get to the finals, right? But typically in the playoffs, you'll come up against teams that will take away your best option. How do you counter that? If you take away Donovan Mitchell's ability to score, he's now showing the ability to create And we saw that with Damian Lillard. Damian Lillard didn't have that extra gear or that additional style of play to counter what was happening with, when New Orleans was taking away him from as a scoring threat. So he couldn't really create for CJ McCollum or any of his other teammates. Now, granted, some of his teammates got to wet the bed as well. But a great players find a way because, look, if Donovan Mitchell is able to get Joe Ingles 27 points and Derek Favors involved and Rudy Gobert in the first half involved, then I don't want to hear that Damian Lillard had no help either. Now, that was just something that was on my mind. And, yeah, we're nearly at the six-minute mark, and I've barely talked about the game. So let's get back to the game. And with Mitchell playing point, as I said, Utah was able to put him in high-screen situations, which is almost identical to what Houston does with Harden and Capella. Obviously, Capella sets the screen in those situations. And when that happened, it opened things up for Gobert, Favors, and Ingles, etc., because the Rockets were jumping Mitchell in those screen situations. So we saw Gobert do a lot of similar things to what Capella does, you know, get the ball and just drive it down because the lane was wide open, or some lobs, or if the defense was collapsing on Gobert after Mitchell was getting doubled from the screen situation, one pass to Gobert, then a quick pass to the corner, Ingles or whoever, would get clean looks for three. It really, really opened up the court for Utah, and exposed some pretty serious weaknesses for Houston on the defensive end. This all appeared to change, though, when Mitchell picked up his third foul. And Utah was up by 15 points in the second quarter when this happened. There's about 5 minutes left in the half. And this is exactly where Rubio's presence was missed, because Houston was able to cut the lead to single digits before halftime, because Rubio's veteran presence and leadership would have slowed the game down, would have relaxed them a little bit, would have got them into a good half-court offense. But they did look lost without Mitchell and Rubio, obviously, to finish that half. The Rockets continued their run to start the third quarter, and they tied the game at 69. And quite honestly, Houston looked like they were about to end the contest early, and that's usually what will happen. If a team makes changes, and they're great changes, and they're able to overcome, or not overcome, but build a big lead on the road up against a team that absolutely killed them the previous game, but then they lose that lead in fairly quick fashion. I mean, we're talking about the last 5 minutes of the second half, and really the first 2 or 3 minutes of the third quarter. So less than a quarter, they saw a 15, 16-point lead just evaporate. It's very rare for a team to stick around in those circumstances. Usually it ends up in a 20-point blowout to the team that's overcome that lead. But Utah, I mean, you cannot question their resolve, because they stood toe-to-toe with them, and they responded incredibly well. The Jazz are such a tough team. Such a mentally tough team, and they rarely concede or beat themselves. And the fact that they are led by a rookie, and they have this level of maturity and composure in huge pressure situations and games, shows just how bright of a future they actually have. And they're only going to get better once they surround players that fit Mitchell's game rather than vice versa. The Jazz, I've got no question in my mind, as long as Mitchell stays healthy, I'm convinced that they're going to win a championship or two in Utah. And I would love to see it, because that franchise, obviously Utah's not a city, but Salt Lake City and that franchise, they were so unlucky in the late 90s that it took the greatest team of all time, easily the greatest defensive team of all time, but in my opinion, the greatest team of all time as well, not including the Dream Team or anything like that, but I'm talking about NBA teams, to prevent them from winning a title. So they're due. They are absolutely due. And they deserve it. They absolutely deserve it. I would love to see them get a championship. It would make me very happy. I know I'm trying to be impartial and unbiased, and people think I'm a Thunder fan, right? So if I'm a Thunder fan, why the hell would I actually be hoping that the team that knocked them out would be, you know, claiming a championship in the next 5 to 10 years? And it might be earlier. Who knows how quickly they can surround him with the right players. But perhaps they already have started to do that, because you think they brought Crowder in, and Crowder has seamlessly fit. It was him and Mitchell that really, once they stopped the run, and they were going, as I said, toe-to-toe with Houston for a little while, But it was Mitchell and Crowder that really got them over the hump, and they reestablished the lead, and the pressure was back on Houston to overcome another deficit, albeit not nearly as big as the one they faced in the first half. But it takes a lot out of a team to overcome a deficit and then have to try and overcome another deficit. We saw that with the Milwaukee and Boston series repeatedly, where a team would be down by 15, 20 points in the first half. That would bring it all the way back to, say, 5 points, but then they'd just run out of juice, and the team that had that initial lead would easily pump it back up to 12, 15 points. And I'm not sure if Houston was rattled or if they were just surprised, but the resiliency that the Jazz displayed, look, if Houston didn't realize that they were in a fight before this game, and who could honestly blame them after what we saw in game one? But if they didn't realize that they're in a dogfight and Utah can knock them off, they'll know this now. They cannot take this team lightly now. Oklahoma made this same mistake as well, and they lost game two in similar fashion. And it was over. You know, Oklahoma couldn't get a win in Salt Lake. The Rockets have to be aware of the dangerous position that they're in now. Otherwise, they'll probably meet the same fate that Oklahoma met in the first round. Now, I'm pretty sure that Houston will be aware of it, because even in this game, the Houston, to their credit as well, even though they were a bit rattled and that they weren't playing their game, they kept pushing and they kept fighting all the way to the end. It wasn't until an Ingles three with about 5 minutes to go that really re-established a 10-point lead did we see that the Rockets just capitulate with all the pressure on them. And if the Rockets thought that there was a lot of pressure on them in the latter stages of game two, my goodness, what happens if they go down 2 or 3 games to 1 to the Jazz? Because everyone's riding off the Raptors in the Eastern Conference after they drop game one. And the Rockets face a dogfight, not just with the Jazz, but internally. When you look at D'Antoni and Chris Paul and James Harden, they all have extensive playoff failures to overcome. In many ways, when you talk about playoffs for all these guys, we don't talk about great performances. We talk about how they've underachieved, whether it's Chris Paul not making the conference finals, or James Harden playing terrible in the NBA finals, or D'Antoni never even making the NBA finals despite some great teams that he was coaching. And now they face the prospect, as I mentioned before, they have to go into Utah and win a game. If they don't, the series is over in 6 at the latest. So for the first time in the playoffs, we're going to have to see a desperate Houston team, because Utah will be, their confidence will be sky high, as it should be, after winning this game in the fashion that they won it. And this won't be necessarily a bad thing. This is a moment of truth, just like Toronto had moments of truth against the Wizards, and now they're facing a similar one in game two and the rest of the series up against the Cavs. If they have championship aspirations, they will have to go through this. How they respond and whether they get through it will determine whether they advance. Now they absolutely have to, so we'll see what they're made of. But this is what makes playoff basketball so special. We see teams when they're tested. No one wants to see it. If playoff basketball is not competitive like it was last season, then it's terrible. Nobody wants to watch that. Nobody, I'm running this podcast now, but it's not like I've just watched basketball this year. I've watched it, you know, a good 10 years of my life. I have never been more bored throughout a playoff campaign than I was during the 2017 playoffs. I didn't even start watching all the games until the finals. I would watch one or two games of a series and even then I wasn't watching the full games. And if a hardcore fan such as myself isn't interested in it, then what's the casual fan thinking? The product's terrible. So this is why I'm excited, because we're going to see this. We're going to see this in the Raptors. We're going to see this with the Rockets. Hopefully we'll see it with the Pelicans in game three. And we'll see it from Philly in game two coming up as well. It'll be fun. It'll be real fun. I'm excited. I hope you guys are excited too. And whilst we're talking about playoff runs and reasons to be excited, I was thinking about LeBron's playoff run so far this year. And it's been absolutely insane. Now, granted, it's going up against the Pacers, who, let's be honest, they played hard, but they're not exactly the greatest team in the world from a talent perspective. Very well coached, You got Oladipo, but the rest, it's just spare parts. I mean, Sabonis might end up into a pretty good player, but the rest of the team is just spare parts. They're throwaways or draft picks that have turned into good role players, but they're not great role players. And I'm not trying to throw dirt in them or anything like that. I'm just saying that they're not a superstar team. They're not made up of Hall of Fame players. But if LeBron James, these are the numbers throughout his first 8 games of this playoff run. So it's not just one or two. 33.4 points per game on 53% shooting, 10 rebounds a game, 8.4 assists per game. There are a lot of turnovers, but I'll live with that because the ball's in his hands that much more than, you know, pretty much anyone else, you know. So if he has to do that much on offense, then you have to live with the turnovers. The only way to avoid that is if he just, you know, if he just catches it and passes it to somebody 35 feet away from the basket. And he's not quite doing that. So the point I wanted to make is, you look at those numbers and that level of play. If he sustains this, and I am fully taking into account that he plays no defense whatsoever. In fact, he hides, they hide him from defensive responsibilities in critical situations. Even up against players that you would never think he would see a superstar shy away from, such as Bogdanovich, right? Now, even with that, if he continues this level of production throughout the entire playoffs, now this is a big if, but if he continues this production and the intensity on the offensive end, and they win the championship, so they go through Toronto, they survive, this is the roadmap, survive a 7-game series against a pretty tough, albeit limited from a talent standpoint, Pacers team. If they knock off the number one seeded Raptors, who have played well this season, now in the playoffs, if they lose in the second round, then whatever, right? But if they knock them off as well, and then if they take out either Boston or Philly, let's assume that it's Philly because they're the more talented team, even though they're down 1-0 at this point. If they knock off Phily, and everyone's going to... I don't want any excuses of, oh, well, they're a bit young. Look, they're ready now. From a talent standpoint, they are ready to go to the finals now. And they may be the toughest team that LeBron has faced to get to the finals. I don't know. Since ever. Since probably the 2008... Boston Celtics, there we go. Go way back there, 10 years. That they would seriously, from a talent standpoint, the 76ers would be there. I can't think of a whole lot more. There have been tougher teams like the Indiana Pacers and, say, the 2012 Celtics, but they were so old and over the hill. Maybe the 2010 Celtics when Rondo was playing exceptionally well at an MVP level. But even then, you'd have to twist my arm with that a little bit because the 76ers, they are deep. They are so, so deep. Anyway, getting off topic. So they would have to go through the 76ers, or even if they go through the Celtics, and we've seen the way that the Celtics have played, especially at home in the playoffs. That's a pretty tough run. And this has been probably one of the worst supporting casts LeBron has had, at least since he bolted to Cleveland to South Beach. So if he's able to get him to the finals, I'll give him a standing ovation for that. If he's able to win a championship with this, say they go through Houston, or, I mean, let's take Utah seriously now as well, in addition to Golden State. If he's able to get them over the hump against those great teams, then hold on a second, maybe I have to put him back into, at least in the conversation of him being a top five player of all time, which for the record, I had him there after the 2016 finals. And I also had him ahead of Larry Bird as the greatest small forward of all time. So I guess that's open for debate as well, if he's able to get them over that hump and continue to play the way that he's playing. But yeah, keep an eye on it, because this could be the last time we see a truly dominant stretch from him. Father Time is undefeated, and Jordan was really the only guy to be dominant at this age while still winning. Of course, Jordan also played defense and made his teammates better, but that's none of my business. Now, because there was only one game, I was expecting to answer some questions. We're already at the 20-minute mark, so I'll answer two questions. The first is, what are my thoughts on trusting the process? It seems like I'm a bit negative with it. Of course, I'm sort of cleaning up that question a little bit. Maybe a few curse words in it. But it's a good question. I'm glad I'm asked it, right? And what process? I mean, obviously, we're talking about the Philadelphia 76ers, but what was the process exactly? They basically just lucked out in the lottery enough times before they put a team together. They're not geniuses. If you look at the drafting of Embiid and Simmons, if they only drafted those two guys, then I'd say, well, yeah, they've got an eye for talent because those were the only two picks. But they weren't the only two picks. For every, you know, Joel Embiid, there was an Okafor. For every Ben Simmons, there was a Fultz. But, okay, we don't know how good he may develop. He's showing signs. So let's be honest here. For every Ben Simmons, there's a Nerlens Noel, for example. Remember, they traded Jrue Holiday for him. Noel was actually a draft pick by the Hornets. Basically, what I'm trying to say is they had no idea what they were doing apart from basically sabotaging their team to get draft picks. No team embraced the tanking era worse than the 76ers. And it's funny how we hear all about the Jordan's Bulls teams benefiting from expansion. And the people say, oh, the league was watered down or whatever. But the tanking era infected about 30% of the teams nearly every single season. And if it sounds like I'm agitated by this, you're absolutely right I'm agitated by it. It's a joke to the game. It's an absolute embarrassment. That's why I wince when I hear the pathetic slogan, oh, trust the process. Especially when fans say it, because the fans get shortchanged by it. And that's not to say that I don't like this current Philly team. But let's compare their strategy, for lack of a better term, to what Danny Ainge has built in Boston. Okay, that's just a masterpiece, so maybe that's not a fair comparison. But let's look at what the Lakers, even with that train wreck, Lonzo Ball, they cleared cap space and they drafted well, but they never sat players in a desperate attempt of achieving their goal, and I hate using this, their goal of having the worst record in the league so they could have a better percentage of getting a higher pick. The fact that that's their goal, or that was the 76ers' goal, is just disgusting. Now, of course, with all this criticism, people say, well, what's your solution? Now, I did hear, and I think it was Brian Scalabrine, but I don't know if it was him, so I'm pretty sure it was him, but I did hear somewhere that his solution was to award the number one pick to the team that just missed the playoffs. So this year it would be Denver. And then teams are playing for the number, I guess, the number nine spot, essentially. Now, that's a better solution to what we have now. It's a better system to what we have now, because tanking is just, it's rife. It's ruining the league. It's ruining the competitive standpoint from the league. Not so much this year, but in previous years, it was just horrible. Now, the only issue I have with that is you may see teams that were like ranks that had the seventh seed, like the Spurs, or maybe even the Timberwolves, instead of the goal being making the playoffs, they might look at it, well, we're probably going to get bounced in the first round anyway. So maybe we should be going for the number one seed as opposed to getting the 15th or 16th. Oh, sorry, the number one pick as opposed to getting the 15th or 16th pick. So even though I commend that idea because I think it has a lot of merit to it, it's still susceptible to teams trying to manipulate that system. Now, what they could do, and it's also not ideal, but it should be given consideration because I think it's a better system to what we have now. And that's just give everyone that misses the playoffs the same amount of ping pong balls or percentages to get those higher seeds. And you could still have like protection. So if you've got the lowest seed, then you're guaranteed, or if you have the worst record, sorry, you've guaranteed a top four pick or whatever, but you still only have the same percentage of getting the number one pick as, you know, the team that had the 13th or 14th worst record in the league. In addition to that, I would like to see if a team has maybe 5, 6, whatever years in a row of losing or not even winning 30 games. So they're losing 50 plus games every year for 5 or 6 years. After a while, they forfeit that pick. So after the 6th year of doing that, you don't get a pick for the 6th year. Of course, it resets and you get the pick for the 7th year. But watch how seriously the teams would take it to make sure that they win at least 30 games to get over that mark. So they, you know, and then it also gets them out because it's kind of like a habit. And this is what I was talking before about what makes the Lakers rebuilding strategy so commendable is the fact that even though they were losing games, they wanted to build experience so they had something to build on with their core players for the future. And you might be thinking, hold on a second, they really haven't gotten that much better. But keep this in account. They traded away D'Angelo Russell, who in my opinion is a far superior player, at least at this stage of their careers, than what Lonzo Ball was. That was a big mistake. There's no question about it. But if they could take that back, so if you had this team with Randall and Kuzma and Ingram, obviously, and Russell instead of Ball, then I think they would have been better than the Clippers this year. I think they would have maybe been the 10th seed in the West. And that's not saying much, but you keep in mind with how stacked the Western Conference was this year, the number 9 seed had 46 wins or 47 wins, whatever it was, something insane. So to just be on the outside looking in, all they need is one or two more pieces. And I'm not talking about superstar pieces, which they may get as well, but they're only one or two more pieces away from getting right in there, especially with the decline of the Spurs taking place as well. So I would like to see a situation where if a team like Philly went through where they weren't even winning 25 games a season for a while, because that's why they're doing it. So take away the incentive for them to tank and they'll no longer tank. Because after a while, if the league doesn't do something about this, and I don't mean fining Mark Cuban, although I'm all for fining Mark Cuban, I'm not a fan of Mark Cuban's, but simply fining an owner who's saying this, is saying, well, this is part of the strategy to lose more games, that's not going to solve the problem because, one, he's got a lot of money, he's not going to care about that. Taking away the pick, they're going to be caring about that. Because the other thing that will happen is even in a basketball hotbed like Philadelphia, you'll see fans turn on that franchise. And it's going to take a very special team like they have now to bring them back out, to make them enjoy it again. And it's kind of funny because when a team will leave a city, they say, oh, the fans turn on us or whatever, boo-hoo, right? But if I was a fan, I'd say to hell with that as well. If I was paying money and watching, it's unacceptable when players don't play hard. So what is it? Why is it accepted if franchises aren't trying to compete? If management isn't trying to compete? That's even worse, right? Anyway, that is a very long way of explaining why I'm not a fan of trust the process, because it's terrible. It's horrible. It's insulting. I probably could have just answered that question in that short sentence that it's terrible and insulting. Anyway, next question. What can be done to save Giannis's career? And then the question after that is, would you rebuild a wizard? So I'm going to answer these both at the same time. And I always laugh when teams make the playoffs and have relatively good showings. Like they'll have an underachieving regular season, but they still do make the playoffs. And in the playoffs, they have a good showing. But then fans want to blow that up like it's a terrible situation. You've got to look at it from the perspective, like if Washington had one more post player, like for example, if they had made that trade that I talked about earlier in the season, and that was the Wizards should have gone after Marc Gasol from Memphis, and if they had to give up Gortat and a few picks and maybe Kelly Oubre or whatever, then they should have gone for that, because had they had that presence inside with his passing as well as his post game and his defense, I'm not sure if the Raptors beat the Wizards. I'm almost positive that, you know, the Wizards wouldn't have been the 8th seed either. But had they been the 7th seed or even the 6th seed, who knows? If they were the 6th seed, I don't think they would have been in Philly. But I'll tell you what, Gasol up against Embiid, that would have been an interesting matchup. That would have been real interesting. Anyway, the point that I'm trying to make here is the Wizards aren't that far off being a competitive team in the Eastern Conference. Same with Milwaukee. They were one game away. They pushed Boston to 7 games. So they were 1 game away from advancing. But for whatever reason, fans want to blow these teams up. But there's no questioning, how can we improve the Nets? When was the last time the Nets were relevant? I know they made the playoffs, I think it was up against Indiana 1 year. No, it was up against Atlanta, that 60-win Atlanta team. But beyond that, when was the last time they were relevant? I mean, we got to go back to what, the 2004 season when they pushed the Detroit Pistons with Ben Wallace and Rasheed Wallace and those guys, their championship year, they pushed them to 7 games. That's the last time they've really been relevant. I mean, I guess you could talk about the years where they had Jefferson and Jason Kidd and Vince Carter. But the last time they were truly considered NBA championship contenders was that year. So it's been a long time. Same with a team like Orlando. I mean, when was the last time Orlando was relevant? When they made the NBA finals? Well, they made the conference finals a year after. But I don't think they've made it out of the first round since then. I can't remember the last time they made the playoffs. Was it really the year that they lost to the Pacers in the first round? I think Dwight Howard was on that team. That's how long ago this was. But my point is, we're looking to rebuild teams that don't necessarily need rebuilds. Look at Milwaukee. Look at the talent. You've got Giannis, who's a top five talent in the NBA. He's surrounded with Bledsoe. Yeah, he's a meathead, knucklehead, whatever you want to call him. But with the right coaching, he could turn into a really good player. You've got Middleton. He's a very good complementary player to Giannis. You've also got players like Thon Maker and Jabari Parker, who for very different reasons have a lot of untapped potential. Thon Maker is, what, only his second year? And Parker has been plagued by injuries. So I'm forgetting. I always forget this guy as well. The rookie of the year for last year. I can't think of his name. It starts with B. Regardless, he's got a lot of talent as well. This team has a lot of talent. The point I'm making is, why would you blow it up? Just get a good coach. That would make so much more sense. And the same with the Wizards. You make one trade. The Wizards, they don't really have many options anyway. Who's going to take John Wall if they're trading him with that contract? Maybe you could trade Bradley Beal. But what would you really get in return? Would you be better? Or are you going for draft picks? If you're going for draft picks and younger players, you're still stuck with, you know, Potter's contract as well as John Wall's contract. So you're essentially stuck with this core team for a long time. So try and get one or two trades to get you over the hump rather than rebuilding and blowing it all up. Because the rebuilds are not guaranteed to be quick. You cannot look at Boston as an example, because that was almost Red Auerbach-esque, the way that Danny Ainge has orchestrated that. On the fly as well, bringing in great trade after great trade, whether it was bringing in Isaiah Thomas, or whether it was bringing in or trading Isaiah Thomas for Kyrie Irving, or using those Brooklyn picks to get young players whilst getting draft picks in the future as well, or signing Al Horford or Gordon Hayward, and of course getting Brad Stevens as a coach. If teams think they can build a team like that, they're nuts. Danny Ainge is in a class of his own right now when it comes to being an executive. And I'm not exaggerating. He is just fantastic the way that he built this team. So if teams think that you can just simply rebuild it like an NBA 2K and you're going to be the next Danny Ainge, they're nuts. They're absolutely delusional if they think that. And we're going to wrap things up there. We've got 2 games tomorrow. We've got the Raptors and Cavaliers game 2. You've got to hope that the Raptors win this game, because if they lose this game, it's going to be a sweep. And then so I'm picking the Raptors to win. Sheer desperation. And you've got the Celtics and the 76ers. I think the 76ers rebound. They've shown pretty good resiliency in the first round. Boston, this has got to be a do-or-die game for them as well, because if they give up home court advantage to Philly, as impressive as they have been up until this point, they think, when you think back to the first round up against the Bucks, they did not get a win in Milwaukee. Now, I'm not saying if Boston loses game 2, then the series is over. Clearly it's not, but I'm just saying that if you're Boston, that they have to come out with the same kind of urgency and intensity that they did in game one. Certain performances won't happen again. You won't see Rozier and Al Horford shoot those kind of percentages, but who's the other guy that's going to step up? As seemingly every single game, it's a new guy for Boston, and that makes it intriguing in of itself. But I think Philly wins, and I think I think Toronto wins, and I think we have 2-1-1 series, which makes it very exciting moving forward. But thank you very much for listening, guys. Hope you enjoy the games tomorrow, and there'll be a podcast tomorrow as well. So hope you enjoy it. Take care, and I'll speak to you soon.